or I get that amount of our
We'll call the meeting to order. This is State Government Finance for Tuesday, February 21st, 2012. We have a quorum, and you have before you the minutes from the 16th of February. Would someone move those minutes?
So move.
Representative Gunther moves the minutes. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, all in favor of the minutes signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. The minutes are approved. Members, you'll notice this is not Peter Glessing to my left. Stacy Carpenter is filling in for Peter. Peter is working on taking the bar this week, and so we all wish him well as he goes through that rather arduous process of being going through the bar exam. Our first bill up today is House File 1974. Representative Drazkowski, welcome.
Yes.
Representative Benson.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to move that House File 1974 pass and be referred to the register.
Okay. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, House File 1974 is a bill that would amend the portion of PELRA that deals with the contract terms that happen among employer contracts, union and employer government employment contracts, after the expiration of those contracts. Now, we have right in front of us, members, here in at the state level, a situation where we have two unions, both AFSCME and MAPE, who their particular contracts, and I'm trying to remember, I think they represent about 70% of the employees in state government. Those two contracts expired on the 30th of June of last year. We are at a point in time now that represents the latest in the last 10 years that these negotiations have gone without a contract resolution coming forward. As a matter of fact, members, being on the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, and I see Representative Lilly here too is also on that committee. We are aware of this and having this discussion. One of the things that many of us have realized and through this whole thing is that the provisions according to law and also according to the contracts that are in place or were in place that have expired, according to law, the provisions of the expired contract continue beyond the expiration of the contract. So what we have in Minnesota, of course, and state government here anyway, is a situation where the second year of the expired contract said that the employees were allowed steps or increases in their wages over time, and also they had a certain set of health insurance benefits or representing that contract that are those additional costs are now being picked up by the state as well as those steps. So we're creating additional costs because those provisions, which some of us would look at that and say, you know what, this unexpired contract situation is on autopilot, and there's not a negotiated agreement that has happened, yet these increases are taking place. So members, throughout the biennium, this situation is providing for us additional costs for taxpayers of about $140 million through the biennium. If this situation continues to happen through the end of the biennium. And so that's the concern that brought this item to my attention. And members, it also applies, this particular part of statute also applies to local government. It applies to cities, it applies to counties, it applies to schools. And you'll hear testimony from each of those representatives of those particular units of government. They have some of the same concerns that we do as we look at the state contract situation. We have a situation that has favored the union position over time. And as a matter of fact, members, I have copies of private sector contracts, and this does not happen in the private sector. And so this bill is intended, members, to bring government to be in alignment with the private sector. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for questions or entertain additional testimony.
Mr. Chairman.
There is a an amendment, the A1 amendment. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the A1 amendment.
Would you please indicate what the A amendment does?
Yes, this deals with the retroactive pay provision, and it simply removes that section which denies unnegotiated retroactive pay.
Representative Drazkowski, what's your position on the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I support the amendment. I've talked the concerns Representative Erdahl has, and Democrats also from the last committee, so I've heard it from both sides of the aisle, and will support the amendment.
Discussion to the amendment. All in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. The amendment is adopted. Questions for the author? We have a long list of people who wish to testify on the bill. Representative Simon, did you? There are no questions. Representative Moline.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Can we get a roll call on the bill?
Yes.
Thanks.
Yes, roll call has been requested. Thanks. All it takes is one of you to request it, and that'll be done.
I'm sorry I came in late.
That's all right. the first list person on the list is Brian Rice from Minneapolis Police and Firefighters.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Brian Rice with the law firm of Rice, Michaels, and Walther. I'm here today representing the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis and the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. The amendment that Representative Erdahl just adopted was one of our very significant concerns dealing with whether or not an arbitrator could award a retroactive pay increase for an expired contract, so we appreciate that motion. We still would oppose the provisions of 1974. I think the committee needs to understand that the section that this is amending, 179A20, deals with what happens when a contract is expired and whether or not the terms of the contract would continue. In essence, what this provision says is that a contract term cannot continue if there's any provision that allows for an increase in either wages or benefits, either through step increases, which frequently occurs in police and fire contracts, or if there's even any increase in health insurance. And Representative Drazkowski indicated that this was an attempt to level the playing field. Quite frankly, if the playing field needs to be leveled, employers at the bargaining table can do that. It's very simple. Employers could say, we're not going to have any step increases. Every future step increase has to be negotiated. Every future health insurance increase has to be negotiated. And in fact, that's happened now with health insurance. It used to be that health insurances were a percentage. Most employer contracts that we've negotiated, we represent over 20 police departments, over 20 fire departments. The mode in collective bargaining is to go to a specific dollar amount that an employer will pay for health insurance. It is true that frequently there will be step increases at your annual anniversary. You'll move up from a second to a third year or a fifth to a sixth year in a contract, but those amounts are modest. You know, a year ago the state faced a $5 billion deficit, and this committee had to deal with much of that problem. And the truth of the matter is collective bargaining has worked. There are now fewer police and firefighters in this state than there were a year ago, which means in local units of government, city council members have been loath to lay off those positions. The reality is, in these economic times, that people have lost their jobs. The other reality is that pay raises have not occurred. In over half of all the arbitrated decisions in this case, employees were awarded zero. In the other half, the employee prevailed two-thirds of the time, and the typical raise was 1%. So to say that collective bargaining in this state is not working and needs to be changed, I would submit to members of this committee, is just wrong. It does work, and in fact, you want it to work. The union I'm representing today, the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis, was founded by a guy named Charles Stenvig. He was the head of the union, and he became the mayor of Minneapolis. He died 2 years ago. Stenvig was the founder of the original Tea Party in Minnesota. But he was a virulent supporter of unions. And police officers tend to be very conservative individuals. They vote Republican more often than they vote Democratic, but they're union people first. And what this bill does is fundamentally alter the equation between the employer and the union. And Stenvig led 750 cops off on a job action in 1968. Literally, they were on strike for a day. Shut the city down. Pretty serious, but that was before we had PELRA, before there was a way for public employees to resolve their differences with employers. This PELRA law has been on the books for 40 years. A key component to that is what happens if you don't reach agreement. And in not reaching agreement, we're talking about a small fraction of all of the negotiated labor contracts in the state. I mean, less than 3%. And this provision, 179A20 subdivision 6, provides public employees with some understanding about what happens when you sail past that expiration date. How do you deal with it? And simply stated, what Representative Druskowski's bill does is fundamentally alter that arrangement. It says you can't get step increases, and the only way you keep your grievance procedure then, or your seniority provisions, or anything else that will be in a labor agreement, is if you simply disarm and say we get no future wage increases, we'll have no medical insurance increase, or anything like that. And if members of this committee think that that's a good thing to do to public employees, you can do that. But we're going to roll PELRA back to the time when Mayor Stenvig took the cops out on the street. You're going to create a lot of labor dispute and a lot of labor disharmony in the state that isn't needed. And for what? We got through a $5 billion crisis. It was very difficult. Employees have taken job reductions. They've renegotiated their contract. Unions are about solving problems, and we had a huge, huge problem in this state. And I would submit that the wisdom of your previous legislators have come up with a document, PELRA, that has worked extremely well, and we'd encourage you not to pass this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. Next, Russ Stanton. Welcome, Mr. Stanton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Russ Stanton. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization. That's the union for the faculty at the seven state universities. And just for the information of a lot of people might be new and so forth, I wanted to point out that I think my union probably holds the record for having the earliest settlement ever in history of a collective bargaining agreement 3 years ago. We settled our contract. We just basically saw the economy collapsing. We settled our contract. We didn't even negotiate. We basically carried forward the old contract with no across-the-board pay increases or automatic step increases across the board. As I said, we don't have automatic step increases in our contract across the board. But we do have two kinds of increases that did continue after our current contract expired on June 30th. The first of these is what we call career steps, which faculty members get steps after 10, 20, and 30 years. And those were put in about 10 years ago to solve a salary compression problem that we had within the system. They're scheduled to expire on June 30th of 2013. and only about 5% of our people get those steps. The second is promotional steps. When a faculty member gets promoted from an assistant, they come in as an assistant, they get promoted from assistant to associate, associate to a full professor. That is a process that involves it takes several years, and you know, to get their first promotion and tenure, typically 5 years, and it involves extensive peer review. It involves administrative review, and about 5% of those folks get their promotions per year. About 5% get promotions each year. And these would be denied under House File 1974. And so even though the administration might agree that this person has met all the criteria and they should be promoted, and the person has done all the work to be promoted under this bill, they could not be promoted. And it would be through no fault, they'd be harmed through no fault of their own. So you might ask, well, why don't we just settle the contract? Well, we would like to settle our contract. You know, we like certainty in our lives and to be focused on our work. But it takes two to tangle. Oftentimes, the settlement is beyond our control. First of all, the health care portion of our contract is negotiated through coalition bargaining. And that's one of the most important parts of our contract. And before we can settle the rest of our contract, we have to have some idea what's going to happen with health care. And so that can hold things up on negotiations. And secondly, the legislature itself has been a major problem in trying to settle the contract this year. Last year and again this year, there's been just bill after bill introduced in the legislature to circumvent the Public Employee Labor Relations Act, and to unilaterally impose things like wage freezes, wage cuts, shifting the pension contributions off the employer onto the employee, forcing health care plans to go up to $5,000 deductibles, up to $10,000 out of pocket with the employee paying the premium. I could go on and on. And when you have an atmosphere like that, quite frankly, the faculty are fearful of the legislature, because they know that no matter what they agree to, it isn't going to be enough. There will still be people, they'll say you got to give more, or they'll try to, after the contract is settled, try to take more through statute. And in a process like that, it is just very, very difficult to try to reach an agreement that the membership will ratify, because before we can bring these contracts forward, the membership has to ratify them. I guess I would like to summarize basically with a plea, and that is for the legislature to let PELRA work, the Public Employees Labor Relations Act work. It's an orderly, balanced process by which complex compensation decisions can be worked out by the parties most involved between the employer and the unions. It has worked for 40 years. IFO has never had a strike. You know, our MNSCU employees are overseen by a board of trustees. On that board of trustees is Phil Kroenke of the Taxpayers Association.
Taxpayers League.
Pardon me?
Taxpayers League.
League, okay.
The association doesn't like the association.
Okay. Phil Kroenke. David Olson was our chair, head of the Chamber of Commerce. Dwayne Benson from the Business Partnership is on that board. I mean, these are people that are not going to give away the store. You know, they're very frugal in terms of overseeing these contracts. And I don't think that they need to be micromanaged. This is such a poor atmosphere to try to work out any kind of personnel plan or compensation plan. You know, over the last year and a half, I have sat through dozens of committees, where people have tried to, through statute, change what the compensation plans are. you know, it's a highly politicized process. It's not objective. It's usually not very informed. And almost every decision, almost every vote was a partisan party line vote. You know, how are employees supposed to feel appreciated in a process like that? It isn't their work that determines what their benefits is. It's the politics of the state. And, you know, that's wrong. I have been around this place for 40 years. I was elected a legislator in 72, served three terms. I've been a lobbyist since then. You know, I have never seen an atmosphere like this. You know, public employees are fearful of you. And I think that that's a shame. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to thank you. I think you've always been very fair to us, and I'd like to thank the members for listening. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stanton. Grace Kelleher. Welcome to the committee.
Morning, please. Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We're here today supporting Representative Drukowski's bill, and this basically percolated through our grassroots organization, and my membership voted on it in December at our delegate assembly in a 108-14 vote. They passed it. And what school board members are finding is that when negotiations go to arbitration, we have found at least 12 instances that agreements which contain duration language similar to "and thereafter until a new agreement is reached" serve to continue the terms and conditions of the expired collective bargaining agreement and obligate school districts to grant steps and lane increases on the existing salary schedule until a new bargaining agreement is negotiated. The case most recent in mind is a 2010 case where the Minnesota Federation of Teachers versus Special School District Number 1, case number 10-PA-0859. In this case, the school district argued that the salary schedule contained in the 2007 through 2009 collective bargaining agreement expired on June 30th, 2009, and that there are no salary schedules in the collective bargaining in place for the 2009-2010 school year. Second, the district argued that since the school board has not approved annual increments for the 2009-10 school year, the district is not obligated to pay such increases. And lastly, the school district argued that it consistently held that collective bargaining agreements do not entitle teachers to automatic step and lane advancements, and that the union had not grieved its interpretation. Even with the curtailment clause in the collective bargaining unit that governs and provides teachers' salaries must remain the same as a salary they had paid prior to the plan, it ceased to exist because of "and thereafter" clause and other factors, the arbitrator found the argument unpersuasive. So, Mr. Chairman, when arbitrators are looking at our language and we feel it's pretty clear, you can argue maybe it just should say stop. We're looking for some legislative guidance to tell us how long these agreements go. And normally you wouldn't see the School Board Association up here after one arbitrator's decision, two or three. But there's now been 12, and that really sets a precedent when it comes to this piece of law. And we're asking you support the changes recommended in Representative Drukowski's bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Next on the list is Keith Carlson. On deck would be Ann Finn.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm executive director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 13 of the state's larger counties. First, I want to say that we support the bill as amended. Our association has had a recommendation, a plank in its platform for 2 years supporting the bill as it was amended. before I go on, then, I do want to make clear what this bill does not do. It does not affect collective bargaining. All public employers in Minnesota will still be required to bargain with the exclusive representative of their organized employees, including salaries and benefits. Contrary to some suggestions, it has no effects on the grievance process. Even after the contract has expired under its own terms, those grievance processes would continue. Nor does it have any effects on wages or benefits in effect at the time of expiration of the contract. Those wages, salaries, benefits would all continue as in effect at the term. It doesn't negate the terms of any contract in effect of any salary or benefits in effect under the contract while it's in effect under its own terms. There's no reductions that would occur in steps and lanes, no reductions that would occur in employer contributions to the employee's health care or any other insurance during its terms or after its terms. It has nothing to do with wage freezes. It has nothing to do with the right to work legislation. Finally, even if after a contract's expiration, after its own terms, if a wage and salary increase or an increased contribution has occurred under the law that is amended under those stay in effect as long as they occurred before the effective date of this bill. But this contract or this language does do is simply establish an even playing field between the employers and employees. Under existing law, as has been described by Representative Druskowski, the contracts with any automatic pay increases such as occur through steps and lanes or perhaps cost of living increases or increases to employee health care or other insurance continues even though the contract has expired by its own terms. That is fundamentally a flaw that we believe exists under the current law and that one needs to be rectified and remedied as this bill does. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Winkler, your question for Mr. Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, does state law require you to negotiate steps and lanes or health care percentages for workers in contracts?
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no, that does not.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carlson, so those items are bargained right now?
Chairman, Representative Winkler, that's correct.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, is there anything that would prevent you from not including those in a contract so that they couldn't be continued?
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, no. Although if that is part of the prior contract, obviously during the collective bargaining process and the give and take, there would be something that would be given up by the employer in order for them to get that concession from the employee's representative.
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carlson, what incentive does the employer have to settle a contract if this bill becomes law? If no increases can continue and employees will stay at their existing salary level and existing health care contribution level, what incentive does the employer have to ever settle a contract given that the additional costs, whether it's through inflationary standard of living costs going up or healthcare costs going up, all those costs are passed along to the employee under this bill. So what incentive does the employer have to settle a contract?
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, members, the incentive is twofold. First, no employer wants to find itself in a situation where there's an extended period of negotiations or ambiguity that leaves their employees in a situation not knowing what their pay and benefits are going to be in the future. So certainly there's incentive just to maintain good relations with their employees, maintain their productivity. But secondly, there's also the incentive to finally identify what are going to be compensation costs to get to the bottom line, what's going to be the total cost to us, so that the local government or state government can know specifically what they will have to budget in the future and plan accordingly going forward.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Winkler,
Mr. Carlson, under current law, do you think that employees want to have extended ambiguity under the contracts and not know their salaries and benefits? And do you think that under current law they might want to identify their compensation going forward so that they can make plans for their own household budget?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, I guess I'll answer it in a way that I think identifies what the situation here. If the existing contract has steps and lanes, if the existing contract has increased employer contributions to employee health care, and those may be exactly the items that the employer is trying to negotiate about, of course the employees want to retain the current law where those steps and lanes or those increased contributions or both continue to occur while they're trying to negotiate perhaps reductions in those. So again, this enhances the hand of the employees in those negotiations. Yes, obviously, given just the testimony alone, the protests from the representatives and employees, they want the status quo.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carlson, it seems to me that you're displaying a bias on behalf of the employer side in this negotiation, because what you've just said is that if the status quo benefits the employee, they want the status quo to continue. And if we pass this bill and the status quo benefits the employer, then they won't want the status quo to continue because they will want certainty or clarity about their budget. And I think you're treating them with two different standards. It seems to me that if you tip the balance and not negotiating a contract or not finalizing a contract helps one side or the other, you are penalizing one side. Here in this bill, you want to penalize the employees. But you're also saying that, well, of course, we don't need to worry about that because employers have broader interests in stability and certainty and budget clarity. But employees just want to kind of get what they can as much as they can whenever they can. And I think that's really unfair. I think an employee has every bit the same need for understanding what their salary and benefits are going to be in the years ahead than an employer is going to pay. And the existing law has worked. It's worked. You know, we could ask a lot of questions about school districts and arbitrators and so forth, but it just seems to me you're treating the two sides to a different standard and seeing an opportunity to tilt the playing field on behalf of the employer because of favorable political environment here. That's what you're doing. But you really should offer some evidence that the existing arrangement has somehow been hurtful to employers or unfair, and there really is no evidence of that. So I think in the interest of actually letting the process work and treating both sides fairly, we shouldn't be supporting this bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, let me make it clear, we don't think this, this doesn't change the incentive for the employer whatsoever. Again, we want certainty for budget purposes, we want certainty for purposes of maintaining the morale, the productivity for our employees. So the incentive for the employer to settle is the same, regardless of this bill, whether this bill is passed or not. However, the incentives for the employees to settle, as long as the existing contract has these existing automatic pay increases, steps and lanes or whatever, or benefit increases, is not there right now. And again, we're simply trying to get to an even playing field where both parties to that contract have the same standing. And that simply does not exist under current law.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carlson, a question for you, trying to compare what you experienced in local governments with what I'm seeing play out here at the state with the unsettled employment contracts that we have now. So here at the state, we're now, 8 months into the biennium, and we don't have a settled contract. And the steps and lanes of the previous contract are carrying forward into this biennium, and so state employees are being compensated according to those progression schedules and all of the previously built-in increases in benefits and wages, whatever those happen to be. And so now it seems to me that the state is at a significant disadvantage, because if we want to settle something less than what that rate of increase is currently happening and in being reflected in the paychecks of our people, that if we wanted to settle for something less than that and apply it retroactively, now we got to go back to those people and say, gee, guess what, you were overpaid or you were getting benefits and things that aren't part of your new contract. And somehow, I'm not sure what we even do. I've asked this question and not gotten a perfectly clear answer, but somehow we're supposed to get that money back from the employees with some kind of payroll deduction or unwinding of the benefits because they were at this kind of escalating level in the previous contract that is no longer supported in the new one. And I'm wondering if you run into that circumstance in local governments and how long beyond the contract expiration your negotiations take. Do you have situations like we do where it literally goes 8 months, conceivably a year, where you then have to retroactively somehow fit these benefits in with the employees?
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, members, I cannot identify specific situations with my 13 member counties. And I further want to make clear, under the provisions of these bills, there's no required give back. That the steps and lanes that may have occurred since expirations that of the contract by its own terms, they stay in effect, but they could subsequently be negotiated otherwise. But the specific issue that has occurred was identified by Ms. Kelleher. There have several arbitrators' awards where the arbitrator said basically that, well, there were these steps and lanes that have occurred since the contract expired by its own terms. The base for which we are going to determine the ultimate settlement includes those steps and lanes that occurred subsequent to the contract's expiration. So that, I think, is the best example I give you of the disadvantage that employers have been placed under the current situation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just an observation. Representative Winkler's comments seem to imply that the purpose of this was to create an unlevel playing field, and my observation is that we just get into all these hairy rat's nests every time you have contracts that expire and you haven't settled for the next term, and now you're trying to somehow unwind or retrofit what's water under the bridge in that intervening period where they're operating under the old contracts in the new contract period. And so this, I think, just makes it a much more stable environment, a much fairer one, where the previous contract terms in effect just perpetuate as compared to going along with the escalation of the prior contracts, assuming that escalation. So I like the bill a lot, and maybe Representative Drazkowski can, when he gets back to the mic, can offer some perspective on the discussion between Representative Winkler and Mr. Carlson and what we're experiencing here at the state, too.
Representative Drazkowski, and then we need to move on. We've got, we're not even halfway through the testifiers yet. So Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I think we're getting at the heart of the discussion about this bill, exactly where are we at, and is it a level playing field or is it not? And members, I maintain that it is not. As a matter of fact, if the culture of union contract agreements over the history of our state were different, and there was actually provisions in the contract for a planned decrease in wages or for a planned decrease for some reason in the cost of insurance benefits, members, the unions would be here with this bill today.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Next is Ann Finn, and on deck, Jody Burr.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. The League supports House File 1974. I want to be clear that we also support PELRA. Our members deeply support the work of public employees. and we want them to be fairly compensated. This our position on this bill was weighed carefully during a process that we undertake every year during the interim, and we do have a policy position in support of this legislation. Unions that have favorable contract terms, such as step pay increases and percentage-based health insurance contributions from the city, usually those have been, in many cases, have been negotiated during more sunny fiscal times, may have little incentive to settle a contract. What we've heard from opponents of this bill is that the issue it is attempting to address should be resolved in the bargaining process. The fact is, they can't be resolved during the bargaining process if there is little or no incentive to settle. That is, if one group, either labor or management, believes the existing contract is preferable to the likely outcome of a renegotiated contract. What this bill does is it moves both parties toward a negotiated settlement reached under existing and not outdated financial circumstances. And that's all I have.
Thank you, Ms. Finn. Jody Burr, and on deck, Lynn Nordgren. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, Jody Burr with Education Minnesota. I'd like to just start by giving some reference. We've been talking about employees and employers, and I just heard the phrase, those people. From our perspective, the people that we're talking about are our teachers that are teaching our children. So I just want to put that out there for all of us as we really think about what we're talking about here today. And so this bill will definitely decrease the likelihood that there will be labor peace. That was mentioned before. Brian mentioned it in his testimony, and I'd like to echo that. By providing the employer no incentive to settle. And I'd also like, from Education Minnesota's perspective, to talk about, with the removal of the January 15th contract deadline for teachers that happened, and then with this, there will be absolutely no incentive to settle. When the January 15th contract deadline was in effect, we had about 18 that were not settled, and with the removal of it, we had about 184 contracts that were not settled. So having a deadline does matter and does encourage both parties to come to the table and work collaboratively. So I'd like to also encourage you to support reinstatement of that. If this bill is passed, it will definitely harm the employees, unlike what has been said, and their wages will, in fact, be cut due to increased health costs, and it will increase the likelihood of strike activity as well, again, because there will be no incentive to come to the table. This does not level the playing field. In fact, it tips it the other way. And our concern, we talk a lot this session about the quality of our educators, which is first and foremost from Education Minnesota's perspective for our kids. And if this passes, what does this say to people? Where will be the encouragement that we treat you respectfully and want you to come into this profession for our kids? So who will be teaching our children? I think this is flies in the face of what we say we're really about. Our teachers are fair and reasonable people, and they are very passionate about what they do. So I encourage you to let PELRA work. I encourage you to allow good faith negotiations, which we believe our people come to the table to do. And please do not support this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members.
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you. Can I ask the testifier, what's the purpose of the schools?
Yes, Ms. Burt.
Mr. Chairman, representative, the purpose of the schools is to educate our children. Representative.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Lynn Nordgren, on deck, Bob Johnson.
Chair Lanning, good morning. Chair Lanning and representatives, good morning. I am Lynn Nordgren, president of the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers, and I represent 3,300 teachers and 1,400 education support professionals. I would like to share a few points with you as a partial explanation of why we oppose this bill. Contract bargaining requires some major characteristics to ensure that we have contracts that are good for students, fair for teachers, create continuous improvement of school systems and education overall. There must be trust, collaboration, and proper timing to get it right. There needs to be mutual involvement. Collaboration leads to trust. The majority of locals, in partnership with districts, use something now that's called interest-based bargaining. It's a very principled bargaining process. It's also what much of the rest of the world use. We tout Finland as being this wonderful place where all kind of good things are happening, and they have this interest-based bargaining. They think of unions as partners, not as enemies. This interest-based bargaining process results in also having intact relationships once negotiations is completed, and that helps us implement what we just negotiated. It creates trust amongst us all. It's an outmoded perception to think that during negotiations we just hammer each other over the head into submission. Taking proper time to think through many complex issues allows us time to find productive and positive solutions together. We have many challenges and opportunities that we face in public education. We need the time to think them through. The MFT is also about continuous improvement. Our contract, if you've seen it, is pretty thick, but most of what's in there is about getting it right. Through this labor management process, we were the first in the country to create something called achievement of tenure. Nobody just shows up for 3 years and has a few evaluations in our district. It's a very rigorous process. That took time at the table to negotiate. We also created the peer assistance and review, one of the first in the country to do that. Through this process, colleagues have come to support one another, but we've also, over the last 12 years, been able to move out professionally and respectively 500 teachers who are not willing or able to live up to the practice that we believe is best. By the way, before we had that in our contract, the number of teachers that were laid off were much fewer when the district was in sole control. It was through bargaining that we were able to really drill down on quality learning, teaching and learning. We were the first to negotiate standards of effective instruction. The union brought those to the table. Teachers didn't have a set of standards before that. That took time as well. It wasn't something we could have gotten done by June 30th. We now have teachers. All new teachers use those standards with their mentors. All teachers who are struggling have mentors who help them with those standards. And all teachers are asked to use them as a reflective tool to improve their practice. We also created self-governed schools. We have our first one being opened this fall. That took time to do this and to think it through. All this quality language focuses on educating kids better and taking enormous amount of time to make sure we're getting it right. Another important consideration is that our negotiation teams are made up of teachers. They do not want to leave the classroom to come to the bargaining table. They need to be in their classrooms during spring when testing is taking place. So if we shorten this to June, we are going to leave those teachers out. And it's critical that we make sure they are strong partners because they're the practitioners. They're the ones with the ideas about how we make education better. If we leave them out, we leave out their ideas. And finally, fairness. The long-held concept of level playing field is out the window with this bill. School boards, who we heard enthusiastically support it, should be reminded of the renowned W.E. Deming's number one tenet of quality management, which is value your employees. This bill takes us in the opposite direction at a time when valuing teachers is critical. The United States is already struggling. This is our biggest thing right now. We're struggling to get people to be teachers. We feel that teaching has been taken away from us. We feel like we've been turned into Stepford teachers, that real teaching and learning is gone. With that, we have many people who do not want to come into this profession anymore, and there are many who love children and love teaching who feel they can't do what's best anymore because of the oppressive nature of the many, many bills that are now sitting on top of their backs. This bill will add to that. As you focus on takeaways, I implore you to look at this issue from a 30,000-foot level. Without having any kind of stability, salary security, benefit balance, or professional voice, who will come into our profession? Who will teach the children?
Thank you, Ms. Nordgren.
Thank you.
Bob Johnson, and on deck, Richard Kalaziski.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Robert Johnson. I'm here representing Teamsters Local 320, approximately 11,000 workers in the state of Minnesota. I'm going to keep my comments brief this morning because I believe that Mr. Stanton and Mr. Rice did an excellent, superb job in identifying how bad this piece of legislation is. If you haven't looked at the number of bills that Mr. Stanton referenced, you should. We have turned PELRA upside down, a law that has worked so effectively, and yet I sit and I question the author in terms of Finn and Mr. Carlson in terms of how this is going to level the playing field. This isn't going to level the playing field. It's going to tilt the playing field in the way that the employer will have it, not the way the employee has it. I'm very concerned about this legislation and other pieces that are going through. I just cannot say enough in terms of our opposition to this legislation. With that, thank you, members.
Representative Leidiger.
I've heard a lot of testimony today, but I want to ask you this question. So who is the employer here?
Johnson? Mr. Chairman, Representative, the employer is multifaceted. It is. I have deputy sheriffs, I have jailers, I have public defenders, I have food service workers at the University of Minnesota, I have plow drivers up in Duluth. I'm not just representing one group of employees with teachers. I'm across the board. We have over 25 different professions, and in that question then is there will be over 25 employers.
Representative Leidiger.
Where does that money come from to pay these people?
Well, that money comes directly from the state or from local property taxes, depending on what area of job vocation you're talking about.
Representative Leidiger.
So it's safe to say it's taxpayer money, so it's the people, right?
Mr. Johnson?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Richard Kalaziski, and on deck... Julie Blyle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Richard Kajewski, the Public Affairs and Communications Director for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. In my capacity, I represent 13,000 state professional employees. Let me first start by taking a look at our 2009 negotiated settlement. And I've heard the comments about the contract that's expired has taken so long to negotiate a new one. So let's take a look at the last one. We negotiated a settlement with the governor, Governor Pawlenty, with the legislature. Most of you around this table voted in favor of that contract in 2009. In 2009, our negotiation team is no different than it is today. Our members elect them from 22 different regions around the state of Minnesota. Most of them your constituents around this table. And that's who negotiates our contract. That's who's responsible. They're the ones who make the recommendation to our board of directors before it goes to all of the membership for a vote. Mr. Chair and members, this contract that we're under now has taken longer than any of the contracts in the past. And to no fault of those members on our negotiations team. They didn't choose to have a government shutdown. They didn't have input on a government shutdown, and most of those members lost in excess of 5% of their pay in 2011. That delayed contract negotiations severely. And Mr. Chair, members, our members would rather have a collective bargaining agreement that's been negotiated and passed by the legislature and themselves than not. They don't want this sitting out in limbo anymore than anybody else. You heard The Legislative Coordinating Commission held a meeting during this session. We've heard from Assistant Commissioner Barb Holmes, the state's chief negotiator, testify that we have not had excess amounts or numbers of contract negotiating meetings when compared with past collective bargaining agreements. We are on schedule. And I've heard from Mr. Carlson and how this bill doesn't impact collective bargaining. Well, the fact of the matter is this bill amends the Public Employee Labor Relations Act. It has everything to do with collective bargaining. Underlines 1.13 and on. You can't extend it if there's an increase. Members, I brought up the 2009 collective bargaining agreement to point out a simple fact, and that is the Pawlenty administration and most of you who voted in favor of that collective bargaining agreement voted in favor of the step increases that Representative Duskowski is talking about in this bill and ensuring that they don't continue. In fact, under that 2009 agreement that was voted for, that contract would not be in effect. Things that we negotiated, such as just cause, wages, holiday pay, health care benefits, things that we all receive around this room, wouldn't be in effect under this bill. Not by the choice of the state employees who are working today. We have the same issue that the teachers do, members. These people have to take time off work. You know, to say, well, we just want to expedite the contract, let's meet every day this week. It's not that easy. We have to take people out of almost every agent, every major agency in the state of Minnesota to get this agreement done. It's a very expensive process. It's well thought out. And to hear Representative Duskowski say, if the shoe were on the other foot, the unions would be offering this bill. We've had step freezes. Members, we've had repeated cost of living freezes. And I've testified many times before this committee and the State Government Policy Committee that the state has a Hay Study system that determines everybody's fair market value. And that Hay Study system isn't at step three of a 12-step pay scale, which is where most people in state government, on average, are hired. It's at the top. And that's why under the 2009 agreement, members, there was 1 year of step freezes, and the second year they were implemented in back in the contract. And that's why when the contract continues, those continued. It's not because our members are paid in excess. They're not getting something they shouldn't have. This was already negotiated. So to hear the supporters of this bill up here saying this can't be negotiated, this was negotiated, members. So in closing, I'd urge you not to support this bill. All of the provisions that I'm talking about today can be negotiated, have been negotiated, and will be negotiated. Our members believe in the negotiations process and the collective bargaining process and would like it to continue in that matter. And in a matter of full disclosure, members, I would urge the legislature to not get involved in the collective bargaining process. They have not inserted themselves in that process in the past. I know Representative Duskowski was an author on one of the bills that went to the governor from the Legislative Coordinating Commission, telling him what he expected to be negotiated with state employees. That's not how you bargain a contract, and neither is this type of legislation. So with that, members, I stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kolodziejski. Judy Blyle.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Julie Blyle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5. We're a union representing 43,000 workers who advocate for excellence in public services, dignity in the workplace, and opportunity and prosperity for all workers. AFSCME represents 18,000 state employees, and let me be clear, 18,000 state employees that would be harmed by the passage of House File 2033, and Representative Duskowski's bill that's before you today. And the reason I reference both of them together is public employees are under constant attack. The testifiers before you indicated the many avenues this legislature is looking at to go after collective bargaining, whether that be PELRA, whether that be privatization and eliminating jobs. We have a couple of public employees that walked in the room here that are our members. it's very difficult to sit down and explain to them, you are going to spend the day going from hearing to hearing under attack. Under attack when this legislature ran on the issue of creating jobs, improving Minnesota, doing what's right for Minnesota. Public employees are being attacked. Make no mistake about it. Everyone wants to say, this is not Wisconsin. You know what? This is Wisconsin in piecemeal. Each bill that's being introduced that goes after public employees adds up to the same net result. It adds up to taking away collective bargaining from public employees, destroying union rights, destroying jobs in the state. The people before me dissected the bill. I'm taking it from an overall perspective. We urge you to defeat the proposal before you and also the other proposals which attack collective bargaining. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Blyle. We've had a request from one of the previous testifiers to be able to respond to comments made by a previous testifier. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to call Mr. Rice and Mr. Carlson back to the stand so that Mr. Rice can make his point and Mr. Carlson can respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll be brief again. Brian Rice representing the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis and the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. My comments are directed to comments Mr. Carlson made earlier in his testimony, and I would really urge all the members of the committee, because Pella is a bill that when it was fashioned, you had an employer group and an employee group at the table the way you do workers' comp, so that the bargaining field truly was level. That's because you wanted labor peace, just like you've worked out in workers' comp. I call the members of the committee's attention to page 1, line 13, 14, and 15. This is really, really critical because this bill, if it does pass, will force employees to give up any future step increases, any annual increases, if they want to maintain their seniority and their grievance proceedings, procedures. A contract term does not continue in effect and is not enforceable after the expiration date stated in the contract, and the parties may not agree to extend or honor a contract term beyond the expiration of the contract if the contract term would provide a wage or salary increase to an employee, including but not limited to an increase based on cost of living, longevity, education, training, or performance, or merit, or provide an increase in the dollar amount of an employer contribution for health insurance above the amount paid in the expired contract. So what this means is that the bill you're voting on will say all contracts are not in effect if they contain any future increase. So what you've done, or what you would do, members, is put unions throughout this state to forego any annual increase, any health insurance increase, in order to maintain their grievance procedures, in order to maintain their seniority, in order to maintain any one of a provision in a... Some of these contracts are 40, 50 pages. Mr. Carlson was absolutely wrong. This bill is going to force... It's going to coercively force unions to give up any future step increases in order to maintain other provisions of the contract they bargain. It's just that simple. I'd really urge members to read this language. Mr. Carlson's just wrong. Thank you for indulging, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, I have discussed this with Mr. Shepard, the counsel to the committee, and I think what you have to decipher here is that the language, a contract term, references only the specific term of the contract. If the language read a contract without the subsequent reference to term, then Mr. Rice is correct. But because it is modified with the word a contract term, does not continue into effect. And then goes on, starting on the bottom of, or the end of line 115, if the contract term would provide a wage or salary increase or continuing on page on line 1.19, provide an increase in the dollar amount of an employer contribution to insurance benefits. It's only with reference to those specific terms. Again, I spoke with Mr. Shepherd about this, asked him if he thought it was necessary for clarification to make that absolutely clear. Certainly from our organization's perspective, we would welcome that clarity if that's necessary, but the intent here is clearly to only identify those issues with regards to wage and salary increases after the contract's expiration or contribution increases after the contract's expiration.
Mr. Shepherd, is that your understanding of the language?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it is. I'm not totally certain that I would disagree with Mr. Rice either, though. I think both of the positions you heard could be compatible. But I do agree that if you look at lines 1.9 to 1.12 of the bill, it maintains the language that says that the terms of an existing contract continue in effect. It's not striking the entire contract on the expiration date. It's saying everything remains in effect and except as provided, and then there's some certain things that don't remain in effect. And so that, I don't know, the author of the bill, Representative Drazkowski, may have some other thoughts, but that's my understanding. What I understood Mr. Rice to say was that if that were the case, he's arguing, I think, that the unions would have to, because those terms don't remain in effect, they'd have to give up something else in order to get the increases.
Representative Drazkowski, do you wish to weigh in on the issue?
Oh, I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And members, I agree with what Mr. Carlson said, and the intent of the author here is to focus specifically on those terms identified in 1.16 or 1.7, I can't tell on the sheet, through 1.20 of the bill. So, it's specific to those terms, and I think as Mr. Shepherd read the bill and the existing language there, it's clear that the bill was written to correspond with and articulate with the existing language and statute to do that.
Okay, members, I'm sorry, we need to move on. We've got another bill, and I wanted to give you both an opportunity, and my interpretation of the intent here would be the same as Mr. Carlson. In terms of this language, we have a need for a technical amendment. Mr. Shepherd, do you want to make the point with regard to what's needed here?
Mr. Chair and members, starting on 1.13 of the bill, you'll notice it creates a new paragraph B, and just technically it would be correct on page 1, line 9, before the word during, to insert an underscored in parentheses A. And that is written down from Ms. Carpenter.
Okay, Representative Benson, do you want to move that amendment?
So move that amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Any discussion on that technical amendment? All in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. The amendment is adopted. Back now to Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we done with all the testifiers?
We are done with the testifiers, and so it's open now for discussion with the committee.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. There's been a lot of talk here today about neutrality. I don't see it because I'm reading the language of the actual bill, at least as I'm reading it. I think the key is line 1.10. It says that in terms of the period beyond when the right to strike matures, the additional time only comes if the parties agree. If the parties agree, it goes on autopilot, only if the parties agree. And now we see in line 1.14, the parties may not agree to certain conditions. So we're going from a culture and a climate of agreement in terms of the so-called autopilot to one where agreement is forbidden. The parties may not, they shall not agree. I don't know if we ever want to go there when it comes to collective bargaining and tell parties what they can or can't agree on, except in major circumstances and extraordinary situations. But here, we're saying that they must not, they may not agree on certain things. To me, this looks like a bill that, despite the author's good intentions, has the effect, anyway, of correcting the mistakes of management, whether it's a city council or a school board or the state of Minnesota. Any management entity can negotiate a contract that is airtight, that is ironclad in terms of a so-called autopilot contract beyond the period at which the right to strike matures. So if management didn't bargain hard enough, if they weren't savvy enough in a negotiating posture to negotiate something that made clear that after a certain time, after the right to strike matures, that over means over, end means end, that's not our fault at the legislature, and I don't think we should be called upon to bail out a county, a school district, a city, or the state of Minnesota if negotiators didn't see fit to negotiate a provision that said what they thought it would say. In terms of neutrality, if you look on lines 1.16 and 1.19, the key word is increase. If this were really a neutral bill, it would be a whole lot more neutral if the word increase was instead the word change. Or on line 1.19, it was provide a change instead of an increase. Instead, we're interfering in cases where there's an increase, but not in any other case where there's a change. And it would give me a lot more comfort to know that were in effect. But instead, what we have is something that addresses only increases. I guess what I would say is this is the seesaw battle we always have with what a law permits and what it requires. And right now, it permits the parties, if they agree on 1.10, to go on and on and on and on, only if they agree, if two parties in a level playing field agree. And now we're saying it's not about what the law permits. It now requires them not to agree. It disallows agreement on certain terms. And I don't know that we want to do that. I understand the management entities here today, whether it's a county or a city or a school board. If I were, you know, or I would imagine in a different situation, Representative Lilly used to be on a city council. The chair used to be a mayor. There are others of us in this room that were involved in local government, and I completely understand that posture, trying to minimize costs and minimize payouts. I totally get it, and I understand why the testifiers are here. They're representing their members. But we have a level playing field now where the law says that if the parties agree in a fair fight and in a long, protracted negotiation to a certain outcome, then we're going to honor that outcome. And what this bill does, at least to my mind, is go in and put a thumb on the scale in favor of management and away from the workers. And I think that's wrong. As others have said, PELRA has been very helpful to us in avoiding labor strife in the public sector for 40 years, and I don't know why we would change that now, and I fear that that's what this bill does.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're getting close to vote, and I wanted to just follow into a couple of comments of the testifiers and then explain why, from my perspective as a new legislator, having gone through the employment contracts approval process in the legislature in my first term, why I think this bill really makes sense. There were comments made about this being an attack on workers, and that's a frequently stated phrase towards those of us who are trying to change these structures that we think have locked our employees into something that really doesn't allow them to kind of fully flourish and bring all of their talents to bear on behalf of the taxpayers and their agencies and things. And I just want to be clear, you know, we've heard terms such as labor strife and we want labor peace and this is an expensive want labor peace and this is an expensive process and all of those things. And then we heard on the other hand that this new I'm not even remembering the term, the integrated bargaining process or whatever it is that the teachers union person mentioned is a very collaborative thing. And my observation is that it's not super collaborative, that it's highly combative. And we heard people using terms like labor peace and strife and that kind of stuff. And, you know, somehow we've got to rethink this PELRA structure that has us locked into this kind of a process that I think is not very productive, and it's not good for our workers, and it's not good for us, and it doesn't breed any confidence for the taxpayers. Those of us who just come down to look at the macro indicators, looked at the 2010 workforce report and saw that over the past 4 years, a time of intense economic downturn and job dislocation in the private sector, and the overall cost of compensation in state government increased 4% per year over the past 4 years. And so, you know, we can argue a lot about who wants fairness and who doesn't and whether this bill does this, but I think to assume that those of us who are going to support this bill, in the genuine and sincere interest that we're trying to unlock our people from a process and a structure that really is not good for them or for us, is somehow an attack on workers. I just don't want to let that stand, because that is certainly not my intent, and I don't think it's the intent of the author. He can speak for himself. And another point that I would make, it was referenced many times that we all voted for these contracts, and I went back and looked. I actually didn't vote for it, but I looked at the bill that we voted on the House floor, and it's not even a page. And it basically says the Federation of Teachers or whatever the 12 different bargaining units shall be approved as adopted or approved as written and adopted by the Employee Relations Commission. And then I looked at the supporting spreadsheet, and it's a one-pager. And it shows what the biennial budget impact is of the agreements that we're authorizing are. It doesn't say anything about the out years and what the implications of that agreement are if, in fact, it were to perpetuate beyond the contract term. And so this concept that the parties have agreed, I think the legislature is just so ill-positioned by this whole process to understand what it is they're really agreeing to. I had no idea, even when I voted against the bill, that there were these accelerators in the out years, and oftentimes that's what you do in negotiations. You get a concession in the current period for some future gain, and we don't see any of that in the legislature. And you'll see this stuff come to you this year, those of you who are new here, and you will really be clueless about what you're voting on. And so I don't know that it felt to me like the parties really agreed on all of these future agreements and future escalators. It seems to me there's just so much that's behind the curtain for the legislature when they approve these things. And this just seems like a nice, fairly moderate mitigating provision that will, in fact, level the playing field and hopefully give us a better chance to understand exactly what it is we're doing in the future. But I don't see this as some perfectly smooth, well-oiled process that serves everybody perfectly well. I think it's pretty broken, and some of these incremental attempts to fix it are really warranted and long overdue.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Drazkowski, could you tell me, for clarification, do you lean toward Mr. Rice or Mr. Carlson on the position of the term?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Murphy, I think I articulated that earlier. Representative, my position on this and intent in designing the bill is in parallel with Mr. Carlson's reading and understanding of the effect the bill would have if adopted into law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Murphy. I was persuaded by what Representative Simon suggested as a possible change instead of increase. Would you consider that as this bill progresses?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Murphy. Yes, I'll certainly take a look at that as it progresses. The bill is written to respond to a reality in the way contracts have been designed historically within Minnesota and in local units of government as well. And essentially, these contracts have been designed with these escalator clauses in them that, as Representative Downey had mentioned, as we voted on this in the past two times I've had a chance to vote on union contract negotiations, didn't anticipate that that vote was going to have implications for the following biennium. It's described and brought to you as the contract for biennium X through X. And so it's the reality of the design of the contracts around which this bill has needed to be constructed, and so that's the reason that the word increase is placed there, Representative, and certainly willing to talk to Representative Simon about inserting the word change, or maybe we insert the word increase or decrease. Have those types of discussions in the event down the road that the shoe is on the other foot, and maybe there would be a de-escalator clause that might be in a particular contract that says, you get a X amount percent decrease over time, and if the contract expired and that same term was in, in the next fiscal year, that would be a provision that you'd want to have addressed as well. So. Willing to have that discussion with the representative.
Members, we need to wrap this up by quarter two in order to give Representative Kahn an opportunity to present her bill. Because we're still lacking a fiscal note on that bill, we'll be laying it over, but I wanted to give her the opportunity to present the bill and get it on our table. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Representative Drazkowski. Same question I asked Mr. Carlson. What incentive does the employer have to settle the contract if this bill becomes law?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Winkler, I think it's the same incentive that the employees would have under this contract if it becomes law, and that there would be some certainty in the future, not only for the employees, but in that case for the employer. In this case, the employer are the taxpayers of Minnesota, and they are in a position where they are accruing in unnegotiated terms over the biennium about $140 million that they have not had a chance to negotiate on. I would also reiterate the fact that it would have the same incentive to come to an agreement that private sector unions and private sector employers have, like the agreement I have here between the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters and the Minnesota Drywall and Plaster Association and the Carpenter Contractors Association. They don't have these escalator agreements. They have the type of level playing field that this bill hopes to achieve.
Mr. Chair, we would need at least another full committee hearing for us to properly compare those two labor agreements to see if those terms are comparable or not, and your rhetoric about them isn't actually all that helpful. The answer to the question was that certainty was the reason that employers would want to settle, and under current law, it's the same certainty is also the incentive employees would have to settle. It's comparable in both cases. Representative Downey said that the system is broken, and you're claiming that ignorance of a bill that you voted for was the reason why we need to change the collective bargaining process. I think that's ludicrous. There's no evidence whatsoever that the collective bargaining system in Minnesota is broken. If you look at the total number of state employees, we have fewer now than we did 10 years ago. That's not a sign of out-of-control employee negotiations. We have a employment situation, according to the last jobs report in November, the leading decline in jobs in Minnesota were government jobs. We had 12,000 fewer government employees in 2011 than when we started. The only other sector that even was the second place for job loss in 2011 was IT. IT lost 1,500 jobs compared to 12,000 government jobs that were lost. So it's 10 to 1 government sector versus any other sector of the economy. That is not a sign that the system is somehow tilted so heavily in the direction of employees. And then for the legislature to claim that we're the ones who have to come in and fix a broken process is ridiculous. Mr. Kajewski talked about a loss of 5% of income, a government shutdown that not only was the longest in state history, but was preceded by months of negotiations and preparation for a shutdown where all the productivity and all the negotiation time was completely lost. That was caused by the legislature. And now we're saying that somehow their collective bargaining process is flawed. It's simply not responsible for us to blame employees for our failure to get the job done and then to claim that our ignorance of a bill that we voted for or voted against is a reason to change the collective bargaining process. If you don't know what's in a bill, you should read it. If you don't think you have enough information about the language in the bill, you should ask. There are plenty of people who work here every day to give us that information so we know what we're voting on. And I would wonder if you would go back to your constituents and ask them if a no-increase contract was worse for them or a representative who doesn't understand legislation and voting on it is worse for their constituents' interests. So I just think it is completely fair to characterize this as an attack on workers in the context of everything else we've seen in the last year at the legislature. And our own incompetence as a legislative body makes that a laughable attack, frankly. We look like clowns attacking the circus ringmaster.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought Winkler was going to eat up all the time. Representative Downing, I have missed you. To now, last year we were liberating workers, and this year we're unlocking them. And I just have to remind you that part of collective bargaining process, if people were feeling like they were confined, locked, or suppressed, they would throw their union out. And we don't see that happening. And if you don't like attack on workers and all that, quit bringing bad bills that attack workers. It's really simple. It's the executive branch's power to negotiate a contract, and we ratify or not ratify it. And let's quit crossing into lines of jurisdiction that we have no damn business doing.
Any final word, Representative Draskowski, and then we're going to vote.
Well, members, I guess I'm kind of sorry to hear that some of the discussion has come off of the intent, content, and merit of the bill. Even sorry to hear fellow members denigrated by members of the committee, which I think is not only just very inappropriate and very unfortunate. The reality is, members, around these contracts, and Representative Winkler, people are when they're taking votes in the legislature or in the city council, on the school board, on the county board, they are not taking votes on a contract negotiation process that they expect is going to escalate into uncertainty. That's the reality of what we have here. There's we have accrued here in Minnesota, or are expected to accrue again, $140 million of unnegotiated cost to the taxpayers without their ability to negotiate. And I would urge, as this bill gets to the floor, that we focus on the merits of the bill, and if we find ourselves in a position where we are losing the debate because the merit of the bill is good, that we don't go to the point of attacking individual personalities. So, members, thank you for the discussion, and I hope that we can continue to keep the focus on the merits of this bill.
Representative Benson, do you want to renew your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I renew my motion that we pass House File 1974 and refer it to the register.
As amended.
As amended.
And a roll call having been requested, the committee assistant will call the roll.
Chairman Lanning?
Aye.
Representative Benson?
Yes.
Representative Kahn?
No.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Banyan? Representative Downey?
Yes.
Representative Gauthier?
No.
Representative Green?
No.
Representative Gunther?
Yes.
Representative Weidecker?
Yes.
Representative Lilly?
No.
Representative Lohmer?
Yes.
Representative McElfatrick? Representative Moline?
No.
Representative Murphy?
No.
Representative Murray?
Aye.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Slawick?
No.
Representative Stensrud?
Yes.
Representative Erdahl?
Okay.
Representative Winkler?
No.
There being 10 ayes and 9 nays, the bill is passed and referred to the General Register. The next bill on
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
The next bill on the schedule is Representative Kahn's bill, 2007, and members, the version you have in your packet is incorrect, and so we need to have the correct version sent around. So please disregard the version that's in your packet.
What happened to the ring today?
She has to go in and see if she has baby boots.
Ah, fun. Yeah. The rights of a citizen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for this opportunity to present at least some comments on the bill today. But certainly, I certainly abide by the decision to never move on a bill until we have a fiscal note, so whether we believe it or not. But we certainly owe the people mentioned the courtesy of looking at it. I'd just like to point out that there are two handouts, and I hope you'll either look at them or save them for when we do take final action on the bill. The more elaborate one, this one on the cross-jurisdiction collaboration breakout session, came from the One Minnesota session, and it gives lots of kind of good examples of the kinds of things we hope this bill will ask us to look at. Now, let me start out. First of all, I'll point out that the bill, or what the bill does with counties, is merely advisory. That it doesn't, it's kind of in place, and Representative McFarland agrees with me, who now supports the bill in the way it, in the way. Oh, do you want me to move the bill?
Or yes, do you want please. Me just to, yes, okay. Please. Move the bill, and then we will lay it over
okay.
at the end of the
I
discussion.
Will move that House File 2007 be recommended to pass, and at this point, I guess it would have to go to Ways and Means. But
for now.
There may be some changes. Yeah. So, let me start by giving some historical notes on counties. They started with shires in England, and it was derived from the Old English and Old German words for care. We then go to an Indo-European root for counties, gar, which is to call or to cry, to clamor. It gets to the Latin garriere, to chatter, garrulous. So what shires were was a mechanism for maintaining royal power at a distant place. So the origin of the county is an agency of the central government acting as a unit of local government. So that leads to a tension that still persists today. In Minnesota state law, and it's always good to be corrected, I always start out by saying that we have no home rule counties, and Representative McFarland, who knows much more about this than I do, pointed out that Ramsey County is a home rule county. So the shires became counties after the Norman conquest of England in 1066 from the French comté, from the medieval Latin comitatus, the territory of a count. So the Indo-European root of this is cum, which is related to the Greek koinos, common, shared. So New England town, I know that's more than you wanted to know about where counties come from, but it's good for you. Related to compactness of their communities. So so we had a report, even in a report that, and I guess I misplaced it from my file, I had a report which was nicely yellowed version put out by something called the Bureau for Research and Government at the University of Minnesota in 1927, called for the consolidation of counties, pointing out that they were formed in the days with few railroads, no automobiles, and no modern trunk highways. Today, when we're talking about it, we can add the interstate system, computers, video conferencing, and cell phones. The authors said, in general, these counties have inadequate sources of revenue, are strictly limited in the amounts which they can raise and spend, are unable to pay adequate salaries or employ the special talents needed for the best handling of highway work, poor relief, tuberculosis sanatoriums, and other county services. I guess we've gotten tuberculosis sanitariums at least off the list. So this bill that, the bill that I've put in several times, and I guess one of the things that immediately catches people's eye is if you look at the handout that I gave you on the kinds of things that are districts other than counties, judicial districts and watershed districts. I always like the watershed district map, even though one of them kind of dips into Iowa. But because my argument for the watershed districts is because I'm able to say that these were not lines that were drawn by politicians, but were laid down by the eternal God at the time of creation. So I think that's a good model for us to look at. But in 1997, the legislature, as it usually does, took a part halfway approach to this by establishing an advisory council on local government to study the appropriate roles and responsibilities of local and regional government. They looked in the metro area only. And so I think we can look at that. I think one of the important conclusions that they had a lot of key conclusions which we've kind of looked at on and off, and maybe some of them that the counties are doing themselves. I think one of their important concepts was that the legislature should fund technical assistance and demonstration grants to encourage the creation of local service corporations for joint provision of public services. I think we can all think of the kinds of things we can do. Well, what are the barriers to increased cooperation that we might look at? And I think these still tight finances, state levy limits, state mandates, turf battles, and vested interests. So are the barriers just exclusive? If we look at the final chart that I gave you, spending per capita based on the size of the county and the populations of counties that this effort may be, you can see that this effort may really be irrelevant to the rest of the state outside of the metropolitan area, so it's relevant to where the county populations are lowest and the distances are greatest. And kind of look, there are 17 counties. I didn't give you the list of populations by counties. But there are 17 counties in the state with population of under 10,000. So pulling out my file on this issue, I find all kinds of comments of notes, editorial comments, personal letters, and so forth. I do discover that the most useful track, if you ever want to oppose a bill that I'm sponsoring, is you just refer to how the dopey ideas that I've had, I don't consider them dopey, but that other people consider dopey in previous bills. That's usually where the attackers start. So the negative comments also point out that I'm an inner city legislator and should get to the outer edges of the state before saying anything, and they express a preference for local rather than central control. Go back and remember what I first said about why counties were invested. They were a way to give central control by professing to give local control. So in that paper that I talked about, the horse and buggy day arrangement, the idea that any person in the county could conduct business within a day's travel by horse. Then as now, the authors of this 1927 report are warning that whoever starts out today to speak for county government reform must be as a voice crying in the wilderness. These who come after may see greater improvements, but today, though it is rendering some good services, the county is far from possessing that humble and searching attitude of mind which gives promise of real reform. The men, their word, responsible for county government today are generally satisfied with the situation as it is, and the people are either unaware or indifferent to, or else they are content to let things alone as long as they are not really bad. And then the handout that I've given you points out that throughout the country and other places, reforms are occurring. Of course, we could all do a field trip to Hawaii, which abolished all of their counties and just has one in the state. And so I just want to point out one of the points. I'd like to point out to the Jeffersonian concept that change is necessary in the best concept of local governments as the civic laboratories of democracy. So kind of what this bill asks for is the ability to have more experimentation. And so I don't know if I want to ask questions, but I'll give some examples of problems that we have in small counties. For social services, a small county may have one person dealing with child protection, the aged, the mentally ill, etc. A larger one can have specialists for each, not to mention law enforcement, purchasing information systems, and so forth. And I know that we've seen some cooperation among counties and larger counties supplying the services for smaller counties. What I'm asking for here is the ability to ask, how can we encourage, what kind of incentives, financial or otherwise, can we have to encourage cooperation or disincentives for the reverse? And I just have to point out that I have less real knowledge about this than many people in this room, but I'm just someone whose background means I like numbers, geography, and abstract concepts, you know, like evolution. And so maybe we could have an evolutionary approach to doing this. So that's all I have to say, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We have one testifier that I want to give a chance briefly. Let's see, Bo Burnson. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Bo Burnson. I'm here representing the Association of Minnesota Counties. I struck listening to Representative Kahn's statements, and I find a lot that we'd agree with about incentivizing cross-jurisdictional reorganization, reform, redesign. That's exactly the kind of work that's happening across the state, cities, counties, townships, school districts, across Minnesota today. In the interest of time, I have a bunch of examples I could give you all. I'll spare you. I'm sure many of you already are familiar with some in your local districts. I'm happy to talk to you about them individually. But what we have in Representative Kahn's bill, and I think maybe one of our biggest concerns with it, is that it looks at redesign and reform through redrawing legal boundaries rather than actually improving service delivery. As I was just saying, local governments across the state are already proving that county lines and city limits aren't impediments to reform. Local governments are working across these boundaries to share services, share staff, and share resources. If the goal of reform and redesign is to reduce costs and improve efficiency, then the focus of reform needs to be on improving the way we deliver services. But that's not what this proposal does. Simply making county governments larger is no way to guarantee you're making them cheaper or any more efficient. And I'd like to point out to the handout that Representative Kahn distributed, which has some great points in it about reform and redesign. It specifically cites the boundaries, the public and political issues involved in consolidation, and instead says a better way forward is cross-jurisdictional collaboration, which is exactly what AMC has been working on, which is exactly what we support. I also want to talk about the more specifically in the study is the time frame. Right now in southeastern Minnesota, there are 12 counties that are working together to kind of reform the way that they deliver human services in the state. It's a major redesign project that's already 2 to 3 years in the making and is still in process. That's, now keep in mind, that's 2 to 3 years of work going into 12 counties to talk about their human services redesign. What we're asking the state auditor to do is to redraw the legal boundaries of 87 counties that have been on the books for 90 years, taking into account how those lines impact how the state delivers health care, public safety, road and bridge maintenance, corrections, social services, solid waste management, all sorts of issues. Thinking that that could be done in 8 months, I think would question the validity of whatever report comes out of this study. I also want to touch on the topic that Commissioner Joe Venia of Beltrami County raised when he was at the prior prior committee hearing on this bill, which I know Representative Kahn was there for. He talked about the way county lines help shape our state, connect our communities, and make sure residents have an accessible local government. He asked that the legislature help local governments work across those lines to efficiently provide services to the people of the state, but in a way that allows us to retain to the best possible effort the identity of the cultural and demographic uniqueness throughout counties. Lastly, and I know you're stressed for time, I want to talk about a little bit of the potential unintended consequences of a redrawing the county lines. Because I didn't get into some of the specifics of some of the things that have been ongoing, but I know in Dakota County, 11 cities have partnered with the county to integrate how they do the 911 dispatch services. You could certainly see a situation where if a county consolidation effort incorporated Dakota County into a broader swath of counties, that there might be a change in strategy and some of those existing realignments and reforms and redesigns that have already been accomplished could be lost, could be at risk of being lost. I think if we ask multiple counties to abandon their current redesign efforts and begin a statewide consolidation effort, I fear that we'd be hitting the reset button on some of the meaningful and cost-saving reform efforts already underway. And I believe that we risk just rebinding ourselves in the same types of political boundaries that county leaders are working to cross every day. Let me conclude by saying once again, the Minnesota counties are ready and willing to work with the legislature on moving forward on even more reform and redesign efforts. So let's focus on what matters, improving outcomes and increasing efficiency rather than simply rearranging political boundaries. With that, Mr. Chair, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Representative Kahn, I'm interested in your idea. And I think this is an analysis and a study that should be conducted. I'm not sure the state auditor is the one to do it, that department constitutional office. But I think you raised some questions that we ought to be wrestling with as we try to make government more efficient and effective down the road. So we're going to lay this over, and I'm going to reschedule this bill so we can, when we get a fiscal note, so we can have more of a discussion about it. So with that, we'll lay over the bill and get it scheduled as soon as we can and as soon as we have a fiscal note. With that, members, we're adjourned.